From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In the locker room and on the road on today's Fresh Air with sports writer George Vesey. His new book, A Year in the Sun, is a journal of one of the many years he spent as a sports columnist for the New York Times. Actor Bob Balaban has co-starred in Close Encounters, Absence of Malice, Prince of the City, and Dead Bang. Coming up, Balaban tells us about making his debut as a feature film director with the new comic horror movie Parents. And we have reviews of two Duke Ellington reissues and of the new television comedy Nick and Hillary. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. George Vesey has spent most of his adult life writing about sports, first at New York Newsday and then at the New York Times, where he's worked since 1968 and is now a syndicated columnist. But Vesey took several years off from sports to cover religion and Appalachia for the Times. He's also collaborated on autobiographies with country music star Loretta Lynn, tennis champ Martina Navratilova, and baseball player Bob Welch. Vesey's new book, A Year in the Sun, is a journal that records his reflections on sports and sports journalism. He says he's never really enjoyed the chatty, smile-over-breakfast style of sports columnists.
Well, I always felt there was something a little bit more important to do than entertainment. I sort of came to entertaining later, but the first thing was like a bully pulpit, as Teddy Roosevelt said about the presidency. I thought there was a chance to say something really important, and the chatty Southwest Southern, just a bunch of good old boys talking about sports, that never appealed to me.
What kinds of issues do you want to preach about?
Well, things I try and talk about are race and drugs and money and morality of sports, cheating in college. I mean, I've been accused of being preachy by someone who just left the sports writing business. The point being, I think that I try to look at the moral issue, try to say, well, what are some of the things that we should be talking about, not just who won the games and what kind of good old boys are playing them.
Let me ask you a New York Times question. You're a sports columnist at the Times. All of the writers at the Times, including the rock writers, have to say Mr. or now Ms. So the classic joke about the Times is that if you're interviewing Meatloaf, he becomes Mr. Loaf. You don't have to do that on the sports pages.
No, it's kind of refreshing, although we have to remember it when we're doing something that maybe jumped out to the front page. So we have to, someone that we normally goof on, and you know, he's George or Herr Steinbrenner or somebody, suddenly becomes, we have to dignify him as Mr. Steinbrenner. Even though I guess he, until he was pardoned recently, maybe we didn't have to call him Mr., but I think we did. I think everybody had to be Mr. on the front page.
How did you get the reprieve from that formality on the sports pages?
I think the point was, I don't know the history of it, and so I really can't speak for the paper, but it sort of makes an inner sense to me that a man or woman that's running around kind of sweaty I'm not sure that I'm in favor of the Mr. or Ms. or Mrs. and whatever on the rest of the paper. Although I suppose there's a certain dignity of the Times and so on. But if you had to lean one way or the other for sports, I'd rather not say, Ms. Graff then slid across and hit a smashing forehand that Ms. Sabatini couldn't handle. Or, Mr. Barkley. I mean, if we want to call somebody Mr. Barkley, let it be in jest rather than saying Mr. Barkley then did a fake, stuck his hip into Mr. Oakley, who then responded. I mean, if we're going to call him Mr., it should be funny.
Yeah. You've been writing about sports on and off since 1956. How do you think the relationship between journalists and athletes has changed over the years?
I think it's changed. It's more honest, and the lines are drawn a little bit more. In the old days, when I even knew one or two sports writers, some of us even made more money than the lowest paid baseball player.
Hey, those days are over, huh?
Well, those days are over. We were trying to figure out the other day that even on our wretched columnist salaries at the New York Times, we still make about what rookies or somebody with 1 year's experience makes at in baseball. So it really kind of it cuts the class lines. I mean, they know what was it, Joe Namath, when he was aggressing somebody in a bar a long, long time ago, called him a $200 a week creep, and the guy was offended because he said, and this is a sports writer, because he said, actually, I make $300 a week, or whatever it was in those days. So the ball players know that we're X hundred dollar a week creeps, and it divides us. There is a difference.
Well, you started writing back in the days when Mickey Mantle was still playing, and you write in your book that you've always had a blind spot about Mantle.
Yeah, I would say it's a blind spot, and in the negative, he's become kind of a folk hero lately, and kind of surprised that he lived to be over 50, and now he had a book, and he's sort of cashing in on being this amiable, good old boy. But I can remember when he was hungover and showing up at the ballpark and sort of parading around the clubhouse, bragging about what he'd done the night before, and you'd go over and ask him a question, and he'd kind of growl at you and say some very unpleasant things. So I just haven't been able to drop it. And I know that some of my colleagues have. Dave Anderson and Steve Jacobson of Newsday and other people write lovely pieces about Mickey Mantle, you know, telling stories on himself. But I sort of remember the guy that sort of growled at me when I was younger.
Well, if Mickey Mantle did show up hungover and bragging about his exploits the night before, is that the kind of thing that you could write about, or was that off limits to journalists?
I think that we at I came through Newsday. I really got my education as a journalist and as a sports journalist at Newsday. I think we were pretty good about, at very least, laying it between the lines. I mean, certainly if Mantle were bragging about, you know, well, Billy and I, we were out late last night, we didn't have any problem in dropping some of that stuff in there. Whether we ever raised the question, I think people's consciousness is so much higher these days. I know certainly mine is, since getting involved in writing about alcoholism and drug addiction from a more personal point of view. But in those days, at least at Newsday, we were involved in presenting the athletes the way they really were. And we sort of had an arrogant scorn. This is in the late 50s and early 60s, sort of the chipmunk generation I write about, people at Newsday and the old New York Post, you know, the Leonard Schechter, Vic Ziegel New York Post, and the Philadelphia Daily News of Larry Merchant and Stan Hockman. We sort of felt that we were calling things the way they really were. We were being honest and a little bit analytical and psychoanalytic and all that. Maybe we were a little pretentious about it, but we felt that we were being realistic, as opposed to the old, you know, what I call the breakfast morning, the chatty type of sports writer that tended to make them all into noble heroes. No names mentioned, maybe, but I think there were a lot of them who glorified athletes. And from the time I got into the business, I never felt I was doing that.
George Vesey is my guest, sports columnist for the New York Times and author of the new book, A Year in the Sun. What's an example of an ethical call you've had to make lately? You don't have to name names here, but in deciding what to print and what not to related to somebody's alcohol or drug problem.
Well, one of the things I go to quite a bit of length in the book about is 1986, hearing rumors, you know, the year that is covered in my book, that hearing rumors about Dwight Gooden, that he was just not himself that year. And he wasn't pitching quite as well, but of course they're all with pitcher's arms, there's always a thousand reasons why somebody might be quite as good. But there were a bunch of other things that he was into that year, little incidents of, you know, being late to something in spring training and giving a phony story and sort of not telling his own company the truth about how he'd sprained an ankle over the winter. There was a spat at a reservations counter. And we start to hear things from people, including somebody who's pretty well placed in the Tampa area, started to say, well, you know, police are sort of looking after him and people in Tampa think he's got a problem and so on. Those are things you can't write. You just can't write them because you do not want to defame anybody, and rightfully so. I mean, the Times is the most responsible paper that I know in the world. So we certainly didn't write it, but we did check things out. We had a couple of real good reporters who had tried to check things out, and nothing was quite clicking. But as the World Series was on, Gooden looked very bewildered to me on the mound in that fifth game up in Boston. And I seem to recall writing a column that this is not the young man, that the confident young man who wanted the ball. This is somebody who really isn't comfortable, who looks off into space, who just doesn't want to throw the ball. And the question to me was, and I certainly didn't raise, does he have other problems, except to say there was a history that had gone on that year. Well, toward the end of the year, Gooden was picked up, was stopped for in his car, and got into a real nasty brawl with some police, which is still going on. I mean, the legal ramifications are still going on. The police have sort of agreed that some of them did not use the right methods. And it was a very tough call to make as to how much you can say about what suspicions are, as opposed to, do you believe everything the police tell you, as opposed to, if you're slightly out of control and if your car is wobbling around on a Saturday night in Tampa, you should maybe have enough sense to not get into it with the police on a dark road out in the middle of nowhere. If you're black and the police were mostly white, you get to the station house to where they can't use force on you. And I thought I approached that from the point of view of somebody who'd lived in the South, who was, I think, very sensitive to what it's like to be black in America.
But you got a pretty, that was a pretty controversial column.
It was a controversial column in that I got a lot of letters and phone calls in the following week from blacks and whites saying, you've overlooked what it's like to be black in America. You don't know what it's like. Police stop you from everything. And a lot of very rational people, including some friends of mine and colleagues, said, you don't know what it's like to be driving around. And I said, well, I do. I have black friends, and I've been out with them, and I hear stories. But in this case, there's more to it than we know. And who knows what the police were looking for? Who knows what happened out there? Why get into it with police? I couldn't believe that the police were looking to beat up on Tampa's most famous athlete. Well, a week later, it turned out the hospital released it when maybe it shouldn't have, that his blood level was well above the legal limit for being drunk. And then a few months later, he tested positive for cocaine and went into a treatment center. And today, I hasten to add, after saying all this, that Gooden is a very mature and pleasant man. He has gone through a treatment center with a psychiatrist named Alan Lanz in New York, and he is a credit to himself, to his family, to the team, and to the center that he went to. So obviously things have changed for him. But looking back, my perceptions were more right than I knew, because the signals that I thought I was picking up on were the signals of somebody who was getting deeper and deeper into a habit that he wasn't going to beat by himself.
Mm-hmm. You write in your new book that you were shocked when you first started on the road, going on the road to follow mm-hmm. sports teams. You were shocked at the ease with which players picked up women. I was wondering if that kind of subject was off limits to you, or if it still is off limits to journalists.
Well, I would say strictly on a personal basis, to see people I knew, including some athletes that were married, how easy it was, how women hung around the hotel. I mean, I was only 22 or 23 from a very home-oriented background, and to see the ease with which that happened and the casualness of it. So I said, yeah, okay, but you didn't write it. You certainly didn't write it about people you knew. You maybe wrote about it. The first person who wrote about that in any sort of specifics was Jim Boughton in Ball 4, which mm-hmm. he and Len Schechter did in 68 or 69. And Jim certainly didn't name names, but because he did say that players on the Yankees had played around, that there were parties, that women were pretty common, and you know, he used pretty explicit terms, that Boughton became a pariah to the Yankees and has never been invited back to old-timers games. Now, the question is, do you name names of ballplayers? To me, it doesn't make any point, unless it becomes a public issue with someone like Wade Boggs being sued for palimony by the woman that he saw for 3 years out in California. Then it becomes an issue. Does it become an issue if you suspect that somebody's play is deteriorating? I think you find ways to say it without embarrassing him or his family. I think fooling around, that kind of behavior becomes an issue more when you're talking about national state secrets. I mean, a Gary Hart, I would worry about Gary Hart because it seems to me the man has a compulsion about women, and if he would have happened to become president, would you really want him getting a phone call late at night from the Secretary of Defense at the moment he was bringing in his third bimbo of the night into the White House? I mean, I think that's a problem. You know, John Tower, not that I really know what was proven or not proven, but I think that's a reasonable thing to ask. On the other hand, is it? Yes, it matters, and a lot of things matter. I think more to the point is not so much whether somebody's sneaking out, because it seems to me, from what I observed, an awful lot of ballplayers play well under that. I'd be more concerned these days. I ask myself about Pete Rose, because you've heard stories about Rose over the years. I mean, he obviously played around and wrecked a marriage with a rather interesting woman that he was married to the first time, and his behavior seemed compulsive in that area. But more to the point is his compulsion about gambling, going to the track, being known that he bet a lot on legal things, going to the track. And I never heard the story, so I can't say that I'm guilty about it. But if journalists did hear stories 2, 3, 5 years ago when it seems to me Rose's problem got worse, what's the obligation to write about a baseball player and or manager who has a problem? And I wrestle with that one. If I thought that somebody I knew now, from having gone through this Rose thing, of course nothing's proven that he did anything illegal or that he should be thrown out of baseball, but it certainly seems to me he has a problem with money and a problem with gambling, just a problem with how to live his life without always being thinking about money. That if you thought that about somebody that was in a position to influence a ball game, whether a player or a manager, at what point would you write about that? That would concern me more than somebody that maybe was out at night with somebody other than his wife.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about sports writing, but first we're going to take a short break. George Vesey is my guest, sports columnist for the New York Times, and author of a new book, A Year in the Sun, which is a journal of 1 year of sports writing. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
George Vesey is my guest, and his new book is called A Year in the Sun, and I'm wondering if your year really breaks down according to the sports seasons.
Well, because football is sort of plunked in the middle of in the dead of winter, is befitting such a gloomy and dreary sport. I start with a college bowl game and finish up with a college bowl game. But I think that we soon get to the resurrection, the renewal of life with spring training, and I certainly salute that the way many sports writers do, that we finally get out of the clutches of football and we get down and see some good, honest baseball players spitting tobacco juice and hitting their bats against their feet and all that good stuff.
Well, you say that football is still foreign territory to you. You don't like football or writing about it.
Yeah, I've just never gotten football. I mean, it only happens for a couple of hours once a week. There's nothing to think about during the rest of the week. I mean, to go to the football camps, pro football camps during the week, is to suffer terminal depression because the players are in their bunkers lifting their weights and gobbling their steroids, and you just don't have any feel for them. The only time you have a feel for them is on Sunday when they come out with their helmets on a million miles away from you and they bang into each other and the ball is in motion for about 12 minutes a game. I mean, as you can tell, I've just never gotten it about football. I don't think I've ever written a good column or a story about it. I've never gotten a sense of a player making a personal decision or changing things or how one thing led to another. I mean, they go out and play the game, people get knocked down, people get their knees broke, and then the game's over and somebody won, but I just don't get it.
You'd like to see boxing banned?
Sure. I'm all for it. You want to join me in the? I'm not a petition person, given that I write, but and it's not a crusade that I work on day by day. But if I had the choice, if you gave me the button to push, I would push it because to me it dehumanizes not only the people in the ring but everybody around. It encourages human beings to root for serious injury. The mini-death, which is what a knockout really is a mini-death, encourages people to root for that. They're not rooting for points. They're not rooting for a victory. They are rooting for the guy in the white trunks or the guy in the black trunks to knock the other man down, and they're rooting for the man to get up again and take it like a man, stick his head out there, and then get knocked out again. They want to see knockouts, but they also want to see a lot of action and a lot of hitting. And I think as society, you have a right to say what's over the line, that it's not only bad for the people in the ring, but bad for the people out of the ring. When we ban other things. We ban running red lights, and nowadays, any flight under 2 hours, that people can't pollute my lungs with their smoke. I think that's wonderful. I think we also have the right to say boxing isn't good for any of us.
Well, the first fight that you saw in the actual arena was, there was a knockout, and it was a particularly violent fight, and you think that might have had something to do with...
Well, I'm sure. I had avoided boxing up to that point. I mean, I'd just never gone near it. I'd seen Joe Louis train when I was a kid. I'd been around boxers. But to be 20, whatever I was, 23, 24, and to go see my first match, I'd done a piece with Carlos Ortiz, who was a real tough guy from New York, and I liked him. I mean, he was a lot of fun. I loved being out at the camps with him because it was fun to see him train and to sit around and his handlers. I liked all of that stuff. And when he got in the ring, to see him corner Flash Elorde, and the way on a nature film, like you'd see the wonderful world of the tiger cornering the antelope in some valley somewhere. It was that way to watch Ortiz corner Elorde. And I must admit, sitting the first row, I don't think I'm particularly wimpy about other things. I mean, I've played a lot of sports and know all about throwing elbows and knees and pushing people around, and even football. I wouldn't ban football. I always prefer not to have to watch it. But boxing to me was over the line for personal reasons. Of course, then I was 23. I really didn't come out for a ban on boxing for 20 years later for other reasons when a bunch of combinations. I mean, that dreadful Tex Cobb, Larry Holmes fight, Arguello being pounded around by Pryor, and, of course, Duck Hoo Kim being killed in a fight with Mancini.
You know what I'm wondering? You were covering for, was it Newsday? You were covering the first boxing match that you actually went to see?
Actually, I was doing it for a magazine. So I was doing a magazine piece, I think a sport magazine, on Carlos Ortiz. So no, I wasn't covering it as an expert.
Oh, okay.
Hardly. I was there.
So I was wondering if that would be an acceptable thing.
Well, you know, a lot of things we write about the first time we ever write about them, we don't know anything. I mean, when I covered religion for 4 years in the late 70s, and I went into it knowing almost nothing about my own or any other religion. And yet, if you're a writer, if you're an observer, if you're a journalist, you can learn pretty quickly. No, I wouldn't have any problem covering it. If there's a sport that I've never covered, I wouldn't have any problem reading the rule book and asking a few questions and going out and covering it.
I'll bet that when you were on the religion beat that you got really different quotes than when you were on the sports beat.
yeah, really. I missed that part of it, because just about anybody you met in religion, unless they were hiding something, I mean, I once had a cardinal turn on me in a hotel corridor because I was sort of trying to pin him down on something, and I just happened to find him in this hotel corridor, and he sort of turned tail with his robes flowing, sort of ran from me, which I thought was kind of fun. But mostly people want to teach you. I mean, the rabbis, the priests, the nuns, the ministers, they want to teach you things. They had things on their mind. They would call you up, or if you ran to them, they would say, well, do you have an hour? Well, when you go up to a baseball player's locker and you say, well, how come that play happened a certain way? The player will say, what kind of dumb question is that to ask me? I mean, it's a different mentality. They don't think of themselves as teachers. They see themselves as performers, as doers, and they're not necessarily, I mean, some are, but not necessarily thoughtful people. So when you ask them a question about performance or strategy, they think, why don't you know that? You know, if you're covering this great game of mine in which I excel, why don't you know that? But obviously, more educated, learned people understand that you ask a question to elicit an answer because you really do want to take in a bunch of information.
Were your breaks from sports writing voluntary?
I would say sure. In 1970, Gene Roberts, who was then the national editor of the New York Times, asked me to go to work for him on the national staff, to move from being a sports writer to go down to Appalachia. And I love the idea. They had to talk me into it a little bit in the sense of whether it would be good for my family. And it turned out it wasn't good for any of us on a family level. But it was a wonderful job, and I loved working for him and for Dave Jones, who succeeded him, because Roberts is now running the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's done a great job down there. But I love that job, and if anything could have taken me away from I'd sort of gotten burnt out as a sports writer in the 60s anyway, and not that I like the word sports writer, but as a shorthand, the 60s was so exciting, important, exhilarating, challenging, whatever you want to say, that to have the anti-war movement going on, the rock music, and the youth movement going on, and I was sort of like a, you know, father of three, watching it from a little bit removed. On the other hand, I was very much involved in it, and when a chance came out at the tail end of the 60s to cover America, to get out and see what had been happening while I'd been in the ballpark in the 60s, I certainly jumped on it.
Well, did you ever feel like you were getting removed from life covering sports during the late 60s?
No,
when
mercy. The worst moment
was
in 69 when I went to cover, what turned out to be an epic game and one that we still write about, was the first exhibition game. The first time the Jets and the Giants ever met was an exhibition game in the Yale Bowl in the summer of 69. Of course, not much, and I was covering the Giants, and I guess maybe that's, covering the Giants in those days put me over the line about football, too. But being at that game, being in sweltering Yale Bowl on a Sunday afternoon, and knowing that Woodstock was taking place, whatever, 50 or 100 miles away, totally blew me out. I said, why am I here watching football fatties frying up their hamburgers out in the parking lots and watching all these people lurch in and drunk and acting, go team go, and all these overfed guys playing out in the field, when the people that I related to, for better or for worse, I mean, not that I related to the drug culture part of it, but the protest part, the music part, the youth, shaking off a lot of things from the 50s by the end of the late 60s, I related to that a lot, and I felt so out of place being at that football game.
So was that a turning point for you? Did you make big decisions after that?
Well, I don't know that I've ever made a big decision. They sort of happened, but I think it was sort of an epiphany of feelings anyway, of recognizing that I was so out of touch. And then, of course, in the Cambodia and the Kent State business, I mean, I was covering a game one night when the Cambodia invasion, and it looked like there was going to be a call-up of troops. And I remember writing a story about two Yankee ballplayers, Roy White and Stan Bonson, talking about being afraid that their units were going to get called up. And I wrote a whole story about while all this stuff was happening out in the world, it even touched the ballpark, where the two players who were pivotal in last night's Yankee game, all they could talk about afterward was whether units were going to get called up. And I remember one of the old elephants at the Times tried to give me some answer. You can't write about things like that in the sports pages. And I said, well, of course I can. You know, these two guys are talking about that. That's what's on their mind. So therefore, I can write. I'm not a columnist, not an editorial. This is what was happening last night at the ballpark. And it did get in, but there was sort of a mentality. My head was in a little bit different place than a lot of people I was seeing, certainly in the sports section. And I was very glad to get out of it at that time. And I stayed out for 10 years. And I only went back when one of my favorite editors ever, Arthur Gelb, who was now the managing editor of the Times, he came up to me and said, why didn't I go back into sports to sort of write features? And he never really mentioned the column per se. That came later.
George Vesey is my guest, sports columnist for the New York Times and author of the new book, A Year in the Sun. What sports treat journalists the best? And does that make a difference in how much you like to cover the sport?
Treats a... an ambiguous word. Let me put it this way. There's no sport that treats journalists better than the National Football League for parties, for having shrimp as you walk into the freeload before the Super Bowl, for making things easy for you. I mean, they run a good ship. I still goof on them. Why? Because I don't like their sport and I don't like their pretentiousness. But other sports that I like, I mean, I like to watch hockey, and they don't really have much of a clue about how to organize press conferences and public relations, and that really doesn't matter. You know, to go to the World Cup of soccer, where there's almost no conveniences and almost no information, still, I think it's a great game, and I love to go to it, even knowing that I probably will never get to be able to talk to the athletes, that you probably won't be able to get the starting lineup until after the game the players are actually on the field, that they just don't believe it. I mean, it's kind of a worldview that journalists are bribable and therefore swine, which a lot of, may be the truth in Europe and in Latin America. I know somebody once told me that when athletes came over from Latin America or Europe, he had to say to them, running a soccer club in the United States, look, we don't pay these guys. They really write what they want, and if you talk to them and talk to them honestly, in fact, they'll represent what you have to say. So the general manager had to set them straight that things were different in the United States. But I would say that every sport is different. I mean, you do go in. Yes, there is a freeload room where you can eat before a game, which I look upon as, the least of the problem if you tip copiously. Information is there. American sports are pretty well organized to give you information. But, do they do anything else for you? You know, the Yankees have been sending me a gift every Christmas for about the last 10 years since I went back into sports, and every year I have to schlep back into the office and give it to our purchasing department and say, please send this back up to Yankee Stadium. I want not only are we not allowed to keep the present, but I don't even want to even think about it because I want the emotional freedom of ripping Steinbrenner the next time he does something dopey.
Well, do you think most of the journalists send back the gifts?
Yeah, I think so.
Then why do they send them? Why do they keep sending them?
Well, maybe some don't. But I think it's just the idea of a little gift for you boys and girls out there, just Uncle George in the counting house being nice, and we always kind of open it up and we look at it and say, well, what are we giving up this year? But I mean, it's giving up nothing because it's not mine. It doesn't belong to me. Somebody might even call it a bribe. But those things do go on. I mean, from the glimmer that we get at the Times, and the Times has very strict policy, and so did Newsday, where I worked before. From the glimmer that I get, I mean, I have to assume that some of that stuff goes on. I really don't want to know about it.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us a little bit about your work. Thank you for your time.
And thank you for your interest.
My guest has been George Vesey, and his new book, A Year in the Sun, The Games, the Players, the Pleasures of Sports, is published by Times Books. Vesey's syndicated sports column originates at the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Maxine Hong Kingston. Her books, The Woman Warrior and Chinaman, were landmarks in Chinese-American literature. Her new book, Tripmaster Monkey, is her first novel. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After acting in the films Close Encounters, Absence of Malice, and Prince of the City, Bob Balaban makes his directorial debut in the new film Parents. Coming up, Bob Balaban on learning to work both sides of the camera. Also, Duke Ellington's 90th birthday would have been this week, and in honor of the occasion, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two reissues of the composer and pianist's music. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Nick and Hillary, the comedy reincarnation of the drama series Tattingers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. President Bush told a group of newspaper publishers in Chicago today that his administration has made a good start, and he promised a number of new initiatives in the weeks ahead. The president said legislation for a new Clean Air Act, a measure to curb the increased use of lethal weapons by drug dealers, and a proposal to battle homelessness are all on the near horizon. Earlier today, he spoke to mourners at a memorial service for the 47 sailors killed in an explosion on board the USS Iowa. NPR's Jim Engel reports.
The president tried to comfort the families and shipmates of those who lost their lives aboard the Iowa. After prayers and scripture readings, the president stepped to the podium to pay tribute to the men behind the guns. He told the crew he understands their grief and promised to find out why the accident happened. But he said we cannot, as long as we live, know why God called these men home.
To all who mourn a son, a brother, a husband, a father, a friend, I can only offer you the gratitude of a nation, for your loved one served his country with distinction and honor.
The president cut his speech short after he became choked with emotion. He and Mrs. Bush walked among the family members, offering their condolences. One couple told Mr. Bush they'd lost their only son. The president spoke later in the day in Chicago, where he said we've made a good start in the first 3 months of the Bush presidency, and there's more to come. This administration understands, he said, the American people expect results. I'm Jim Engel with the president in Chicago.
There are increasing indications that Japan's Prime Minister Noboru Takeshita is on his way out of office. A Japanese television network is reporting that Takeshita will cancel a trip to Southeast Asia next week and step down soon. More from Spencer Sherman in Tokyo.
Japan's largest television network, NHK, did not quote a source, but it's only the latest of many indications that Takeshita will not survive until scheduled parliamentary elections this summer. As late as last night, the foreign ministry was still planning Takeshita's Southeast Asian trip. He's supposed to leave Saturday for a five-nation tour. But opposition parties have stalled passage of the national budget for nearly a month, and pressure is growing on Takeshita to do something about it. Takeshita acknowledged receiving more than $1 million from the Recruit Company, a publishing and telecommunications company at the heart of an influence-buying scandal rocking his government. News reports over the weekend said he also borrowed $380,000 from Recruit in 1987. Meanwhile, Takeshita's ratings in the polls continue to plummet. Kyoto News Service says only 4% of the nation still supports him. For National Public Radio, this is Spencer Sherman in Tokyo.
The Prime Minister of Jordan resigned today after 5 days of riots in the country. King Hussein is expected to name a transitional government that will run the country until parliamentary elections can be held. Deborah Amos reports.
King Hussein accepted the resignation of Zayd al-Rifai, the prime minister, just one day after the two men returned from a trip to Washington. There's been no word on Rifai's replacement. The protest in Jordan that began last week over price rises required by the International Monetary Fund turned into a referendum against the government, seen here as corrupt and insensitive. The king appoints the prime minister, and the government carries out the king's policies. However, the protesters made a distinction between the palace and the prime minister. Hussein is a symbol of stability in the country. While there's a measure of satisfaction among Jordanians that the king had acted quickly in the aftermath of the violence, the austerity measures imposed by the IMF, the measures that sparked the violence, are unlikely to be lifted. In Amman, this is Deborah Amos.
Stock prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 6.5 points to close at 2402.68. Declines led advances 4-3 in moderate trading. The volume was 142 million shares. The average price of a share in New York lost 8 cents. Once again, the Dow is down 6.5 points. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The great composer, pianist, and bandleader Duke Ellington would have been 90 years old this coming Saturday. And because of a flood of re-releases and newly issued recordings, he's got more albums coming out than virtually any living musician. Jazz critic and self-described Ellington fanatic Kevin Whitehead has a review of two new Ellington reissues.
Duke Ellington died 15 years ago, but it's hard to believe he's gone at all. His best music is so rich in ideas and texture that it always sounds newly minted. A pair of new CD reissues, both already out on LP, by the way, preserve two of the strangest albums Duke ever made. In 1962 and 63, Ellington recorded two albums worth of tributes to the competition, 23 theme songs of, or songs associated with, swing-era bands besides his own, everything from Guy Lombardo's Auld Lang Syne to Cab Calloway's Minnie the Moocher. A CD from Atlantic Records, Recollections of the Big Band Era, combines both those albums. Some of these themes are lightly revamped, others are ingeniously altered, like this famous number, first played by Paul Whiteman's orchestra in 1924. A prankster like Ellington would replace Rhapsody in Blue's soaring clarinet with a lumbering baritone sax, played by Harry Carney. Ellington delights in such perverse reconstructions. But the most creative rearrangement is by his longtime sidekick, Billy Strayhorn. On Stan Kenton's Artistry and Rhythm, the artistry is supplied by violinist Ray Nance and the rhythm by drummer Sam Woodyard's Barehanded Shuffle. Cootie Williams plays wah-wah trumpet. In 1950, Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn recorded an album featuring their two pianos. It's called Great Times, part of Fantasy Records' original jazz classics series. On a few titles, like Take the A-Train, Duke plays piano, Strayhorn plays Celeste, and Oscar Pettiford plucks his cello. The album grew out of a four-handed piano romp Ellington and Strayhorn would play at parties. When two pianists square off, they tend to play less than usual to stay out of each other's way. But Ellington and Strayhorn lay down thick slabs of music. Sometimes they sound like the great early innovator Earl Hines. Sometimes they anticipate the free jazz revolutionary Cecil Taylor, each of whom sounds like he has four hands anyway. Sometimes they sound like both Hines and Taylor, as on the track Great Times with bassist Joe Shulman. Ellington used to say that he and Strayhorn thought so much alike, sometimes he couldn't remember who'd written what. Strayhorn said the same thing about their playing on this album. It doesn't have the greatest sound, but no matter. Great Times shows why Duke's piano work is so admired by iconoclasts like Cecil Taylor and Thelonious Monk. 40 years later, it sounds as radical as ever.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. Bob Balaban co-starred in the films Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Absence of Malice, Prince of the City, and Dead Bang. Balaban makes his directorial debut in the new film Parents. It's a comic horror movie set in an Indiana suburbs in the 1950s. Randy Quaid and Mary Beth Hurt star as the parents of a 10-year-old boy. They look like the perfect family, cheerful, prosperous, well-groomed. But the boy is scared by his parents. What do they do when they're alone together? What does his father do when he goes off to work? Why isn't the boy allowed in the basement? And what is that horrible, mysterious meat that his mother prepares with every meal?
What are we eating?
Leftovers, honey.
Leftovers from what?
From the refrigerator.
We have leftovers every day since we moved here. I'd like to know what they were before they were leftovers.
Well, before that, they were leftovers to be.
Eat your dinner, honey.
No, thank you.
Your son, the vegetarian.
What did you want to start directing?
I think I wanted more control of my life and things. I think I wrongly assumed that if I were directing, I could set up projects when I wanted, in the cities I wanted. And unlike being an actor, where you're basically waiting for the telephone to ring, no matter how well you're doing, somebody usually calls you. I wanted to be the person who was calling people.
Why did you choose Parents as the first film to direct?
It was the most interesting script I came across. Now, interesting is a fuzzy word, I guess. But I began directing a couple of years ago for television. I did a pilot for Tales from the Dark Side, the syndicated series that's on now, and an Amazing Stories episode, and a bunch of things for TV. And I was at the point where, because I had some film to show and I was an actor that some people knew, I was being sent a moderate amount of scripts to direct, and they were all very much the same thing. I'd seen them a lot before, and they were all very, very securely in some genre or other, and they also weren't wonderful. I picked up the script of Parents and had a very strong, visceral reaction to it. And it really wasn't till much later on when I was working on the movie that I began to sit down and say, why? You know, it was just important to me that when I read it the first time, I reacted with my gut. because that's really what I have been looking for.
But now that you know the why, why don't you tell us that?
Well, I know why a little bit more. I think, as it turns out, Parents for Me is somewhat autobiographical. It wasn't when I read it the first time consciously, but as I began to work on it, and I began to do things to it, as directors do with writers when you're in production for something, I think that I was sort of subtly bending the whole thing over into a territory that I was quite familiar with. I said it in the 50s. I was, you know, a child in the 50s growing up then. And for me, when I read the movie, even though some people who read it thought it was basically a slasher movie, I said, no, you really don't understand. I see this as a movie very much about polite people who repress bad things and don't talk about them. And for me, that's always been a theme I've been quite interested in and somewhat relates to my background and growing up.
Yeah, I see the movie as being a little similar to The Stepfather, that film, in the sense that this is a film about a family desperately trying to fit in and be normal, but it's all a psychotic pose.
Yeah. Well, for me, I've often been the most anxious when surrounded by very polite blue-haired ladies who serve cucumber sandwiches with the crusts cut off. I mean, you sit around looking and go, it's so perfect. When's the bad thing going to happen?
Yeah.
One club. One spade.
Pass. Marty, did you deal me this mess?
You know, you are making a glutton out of me. How do you make this?
Actually, I got it off the side of a corn checks box.
I don't believe that.
It's true.
I don't believe that.
And instead of raisins, I used miniature marshmallows.
Mmm. So good. Oh. Two diamonds.
A lot of the music that you use in the movie isn't horror music. It's really muzak-y hits of the period. Things like Press Prado's Apple Pink and Cherry Blossom White.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And the music becomes pretty frightening.
Well, I thought it would be...
As a lot of that muzak-y stuff is.
I think it's pretty anxiety-provoking, frankly. In fact, for some of the muzak dinner music that we have playing at the dinner scenes, mm-hmm. we couldn't afford to buy things. So we went to, because it was cheap, strangely, we went to Prague, Czechoslovakia. And had the National Prague Symphony recording things like that. It turns out that almost all of Lawrence Welk is recorded in the Iron Country because there are no residual payments triggered to the people who play the music there. It's a buyout for them, and these people were experts at music, so we had hit the right place.
How did you find out about that?
Angelo Badalamenti, who wrote that part of the music, had done a lot of Blue Velvet there.
I think it was back in 1982 you knew you wanted to get into directing, so you decided to understudy Sidney Lumet on the filming of Death Trap.
Well, I had acted in the movie Prince of the City. I played a violent, horrible federal prosecutor who caused a lot of people to kill themselves. And while I was doing the movie, I've acted in a fair amount of movies, but I guess it was just the right time and the right place for me. My eyes opened widely, and I went... Sidney Lumet knows how to do something here that I took for granted all the time. I always assumed the director of a movie's big job was dealing with the actors, getting great performances, and everything else kind of took care of itself. I mean, I wasn't naive about it, but I didn't realize how much the focus of a director has to be on production and production aspects. So Sidney is sort of renowned for being well-organized and beautifully prepared and very well thought out about all aspects of movie making. And when it was over, I asked him if I could apprentice myself to him, which basically meant watching him a lot for about 4.5 months on Death Trap, as you said.
Now, he had directed you in Prince of the City.
Mm-hmm.
Did his directing style look different to you when you were working with him behind the camera and when he was directing you when you were on camera?
Yes, completely. When I was an actor in Prince of the City, it felt as though Sidney only cared about the actors. It felt as though his entire focus on this production was, how am I feeling? How am I doing? Was this a good take? What could I do? What could it do to be better? He was so focused on the actors, and I thought, isn't that great? He's not like those other non-quote actor directors who are always futzing about what lens they're going to use and little unimportant things like that, which, of course, are quite crucial. When I watched him on Death Trap, I thought, he's devoting about 15% of his energy and his time to the actors. Now, when he's devoting his energy to the actors, he's giving them 100% of his attention, which a lot of people aren't able to split their concentration that way. And he gave you the feeling that he was only concerned about you. But the first thing I noticed when I was watching what he was doing on Death Trap was how his attention was focused when it needed to be on every single aspect of everything, on how long it was taking to to change the gels on the lights that were hanging from the ceiling. He devised a certain little instrument whereby you could change these things without climbing on ladders to get up there, and saved another few minutes. And not just saving time, but effectively using it and organizing it. His attention was everywhere.
Let's talk about how you've been directing actors. I think you really got terrific performances.
Thank you.
From Randy Quaid and Mary Beth Hurt, and from the kid in the movie. Do you think of yourself as having a style now in working with actors? And I should say that the best known actors here, you know, Quaid and Hurt,
and
also Sandy
Dennis,
are playing roles really different from what you've seen them do before.
I don't know if I have a style. I guess in the few things that I've directed, as is true of most things in life, what I finally seem to be coming up with, because, you know, I'm desperately looking for a method here of working, is there is no method. Whatever gets you to the place where you have to be to do what you have to do, that's what you need to do in a movie. Some actors like to rehearse and like to talk and like to be dealt with a lot, and other actors would very much rather be left alone most of the time unless they're in trouble or unless they ask for help. And I guess it's taken me, you know, a little bit of time to get myself organized here to the point where I'm relaxed enough and paying attention enough, hopefully, to know who needs what and to be able to give it to them, because I just want to make sure that the performances get on the screen, and it's no benefit to my movie or to my ego if I'm needed more or less. I really don't care. I want to do what's necessary. We had a little bit of time to rehearse for this movie, which I do think is important. A lot of the times people go into making a movie and they've never even met each other. And I've worked with people like Sidney Pollack. I did Absence of Malice. And in that movie, I realized Sidney, who has a very strong actor's background, doesn't like to rehearse, doesn't like the actors to even speak the lines before they get on the set, because he feels it takes away from the spontaneity. Sidney Lumet and other people like to rehearse the movie almost as if it were a play. Some of that is so the actors are very secure when they begin, and some of it is so you can go faster. It's much easier that way. We did kind of a mixture of that. I spoke to Sandy. She didn't like to rehearse, and so I said, fine, I'll see you on the set. We read through the movie once, and that was it.
Actor and director Bob Balaban. On tomorrow's show, we'll talk with Balaban about his acting career. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. You know, today, this week, will mark the first 100 days in office for President Bush, and we'll be hearing from Jim Angle and also from commentator Terry Eastland about the president's first 100 days. It's a tradition reporters have been in since the New Deal to assessing new administrations. We'll also be hearing about changes in U.S. policy toward the Middle East, and we'll be having a report from Jim Metzner about David Fanchoy, the subject of a public television documentary that's being seen around the country this evening. The Musical Mariner, they call him, the man who's in search of authentic South Pacific music.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new sitcom Nick and Hillary is the latest incarnation of the TV show Tattingers. It premiered last Thursday night just after Cheers in what's considered to be a safe time slot. This week it moves to a less protected time on Wednesday night. Television critic David Bianculli has this review.
This is the third time I've talked about Tattingers. When it premiered back in October, I said this new show from the makers of St. Elsewhere was interesting but not great. I reviewed it again a few months later when it had gotten a lot better, and when NBC was just about to yank it off the air for a drastic makeover job. The network liked the characters enough to try and save it, but thought it would be easier to get viewers to sample the show again if it were sold as a brand new series, shorter, funnier, and hipper. Well, the results of that makeover premiered last week, as the stately atmosphere of Tattingers gave way to the wild and crazy world of Nick and Hillary. The change was evident from the opening credits, which start with the Gershwin-esque Tattingers theme, then literally dissolve to the top 40 sound of the new Nick and Hillary theme. What used to be a one-hour drama series is now a half-hour comedy. It's not the first time on TV that moods have been switched like that. Lou Grant went from the comedy of The Mary Tyler Moore Show to the drama of his own series. And Norman Bunce and Sid the Snitch went from the drama of Hill Street Blues to the comedy of Beverly Hills Bunce. But no one has ever made changes in midstream, or with a show's entire cast and crew. Well, most of them anyway. A few faces from Tattinger's are missing from Nick and Hillary, but all the major performers are back. Stephen Collins as Nick, Blythe Danner as Hillary, Jerry Stiller as Sid, and Mary Beth Hurt as Sheila. And there are two new faces. Chris Elliott, the lunatic from Late Night with David Letterman, plays Spin, the new wave maitre d'. And Anna Levine is Spin's sidekick, named, of course, Marty. Spin does all the talking, roaming the loud and busy barroom of Tattinger's while taking and refusing reservations on his telephone headset. Here's a sample from this week's upcoming episode.
Tattinger's? No, I'm sorry. We're not going to be able to accommodate you. Uh-huh. You're just in the city for one night? Want to do what real New Yorkers do? No, I understand that. Tell you what, how about I make a reservation for you and then you don't show up? That's about as New York as it gets.
Marty, on the other hand, doesn't speak at all. She's this show's equivalent of Daryl and Daryl on Newhart, only she seems to come from the Addams Family, not from Deliverance. In the first two shows, Spin and Marty have gotten more attention than Nick and Hillary. But Nick and Hillary do get to argue a lot, moonlighting style. They also get to say some of the show's most groaningly bad puns, the kind that are right up there, or right down there, with the all-time worst puns on St. Elsewhere. Here's an especially terrible one from a scene in which Nick is watching a basketball game on TV while Hillary wants to have an argument.
Come on, Ewing!
Listen to me!
No, wait!
Nick's with a Knicks, Nick!
The reaction to all this nonsense has been the most divided critical response since 30-something. This seems to be another series that viewers will either hate or love with no middle ground. Since I love the bad puns and like these characters and actors, I cast my vote on the positive side. So far, I'm not convinced that Nick and Hillary is better than Tattinger's. But for in-jokes and outside humor, it's still the best night spot on TV.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, in part two of our conversation with Bob Balaban, he discusses his acting career, from his first role as a child in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, to his roles in such movies as Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Prince of the City, and Absence of Malice. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the soul queen of New Orleans, Irma Thomas. And book critic John Leonard reviews Citizens, historian Simon Schama's account of the French Revolution. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Schumann and Debussy. We'll start off with an overture to a very famous opera by Rossini. Yes.